Unified with Momobo Ogoro. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Unified. This is a show where we listen, learn and laugh and meet people from different and diverse backgrounds all over Ireland to hear their stories, thoughts and perspectives. I'm your host, Momobo Ogoro, and you can get in touch with us by emailing unified@newstalk.com. That's unified with a Y-O-U. Coming up on today's show, how can we in society tackle toxic masculinity? We'll talk about that on the panel. In What's Your Story, we'll meet the iconic HIV activist, Rebecca Talent-Halivant. And on the social scene, what can people with disabilities expect from Irish Rail's new assistance platform later in the year? But first, building a more inclusive society isn't just about amplifying underrepresented voices. It's also about examining the expectations that shape us all. Ideas about what it means to be a man can influence everything from mental health and relationships to confidence and sense of community. So we're unpacking a conversation about masculinity, exploring the difference between harmful stereotypes and healthy role models, and asking how we can create a space where boys and men can flourish while contributing to a more respectful and inclusive society. Joining me to discuss this today is two leaders in the field, Dr. Kenny Doyle, Head of Programs at the Men's Development Network, and Cormac Noonan, co-founder of the Wolf Academy. Welcome to you both.
Welcome.
Thanks. How are you?
So, Dr. Kenny, can you kind of give us an introduction? A lot of people have heard the phrase toxic masculinity and what men are supposed to be like. But can you give us an understanding as to what that actually is?
Well, personally, I don't think toxic masculinity is a very useful phrase or concept at all. I actually think it's completely unhelpful and outmoded as a concept. It's often willfully misrepresented by some people, and it's presented as if it means that all men themselves are fundamentally toxic, or that all men are a problem that needs to be fixed. And for people doing work like myself, framing understandably creates defensiveness and withdrawal. And when you're engaging with men or even with young men, there's an unwillingness to engage meaningfully in important discussions around subjects such as equality, gender-based violence, or misogyny. And there's also then the fact that the phrase toxic masculinity in reality really describes bad behavior rather than innate traits that men may or may not have. And some of the traits that are associated with masculinity, such as, say, leadership, stoicism, perseverance, these in themselves aren't bad things in moderation or in balance. And in terms of the phrase toxic masculinity, I have been in conversation with people who are working in education or in curriculum development or in that kind of field. And they've told me that they purposefully never use that phrase for a lot of the reasons that I've just outlined there.
Thank you so much for that. And I suppose it's something that has been, it's a phrase that is online and people are talking about that, and you really debunked it essentially, and how oftentimes it's used as a tool for defensiveness or as a tool for actually conflict as well. What do you have to say about that, Cormac?
Yeah, I completely agree with Kenny there. I wouldn't use that phrase myself, and I think it is, yeah, unhelpful. And I suppose what people are often describing is not toxic masculinity, but a lack of maybe masculinity or a lack of, just being a decent human. So it's just an unhelpful term. But I suppose what we try to focus on as well, you know, when we're doing work in schools with young men is, you know, the type of man that they want to be, and really helping them look towards those characteristics or traits that, yeah, are more healthy and balanced. And I think that's what we should be focusing on, because I think when you focus on, you know, always keep focusing on these negative things or negative behaviors of certain groups of individuals, that's all we can see. So we need to start looking at what's the potential for young men to become, and, you know, try to guide them towards healthier versions of themselves.
And I suppose by flipping it on its head and actually focusing, Cormac, like you said, on the positive and what the potential of young men and men of all ages actually can be, we can flip the narrative around it. I suppose, Cormac, what is your perspective on what are those positive traits that all men can be?
Yeah, so I suppose, yeah, I work with young men in schools. I also work with older men as well. And we try not to be too prescriptive of, you know, this is what a man should be or could be, but we often invite people to explore that for themselves. But I suppose the way I look at it personally is, which may be I suppose, goes against what some people would expect. But the way I look at it is men can be both sensitive and strong. It doesn't have to be one or the other. And so, like, men are, like, they can be able to feel their emotions, express themselves, be tuned in to other people and, you know, really be open to connection. But they can also, at the same time, be strong and, as Kenny said there, you know, have good leadership qualities and perseverance and determination. So for me, it's getting those, that balance of qualities that makes a whole man or a whole person.
And those qualities are phenomenal in terms of people knowing themselves and in terms of them engaging in relationships with other people. And it's traits that in your work, Cormac, is really fantastic to see how you're supporting men to and boys to realize that potential. Kenny, I know your work in the Men's Development Network does some of this pieces as well, and particularly around mental health, supporting men when they struggle. Can I ask why is this work necessary, particularly when it comes to mental health?
A lot of the work we do is based around what's called a strengths-based approach, and it will be very similar to some of the stuff Cormac had mentioned. And the central aim of this is to focus away from perceived deficits or problems in people and instead focus on their capabilities and strengths, how these can be harnessed to work towards improving problems. So, for example, in terms of the work we do with the White Ribbon Campaign, this will be less about calling out bad behaviours and kind of stigmatising people, and more about encouraging positive behaviours and calling men in as allies in the fight against gender-based violence, of making them aware of how they can use their position, the power to make a tangible difference for the good of everyone. In terms of mental health, we've done a few bits of research over the last 4 or 5 years around this. Like we also run a male advice line, which is primarily for men who are being subjected to domestic abuse. But we would also get a lot of kind of referrals into that for people who are having mental health problems, counselling service and stuff like that as well. And this runs across the whole range of problems that men can have. The most recent piece of research we've done is actually around fatherhood and care. Something that was striking from this is the extent to which many men still hold quite traditional views about the gender roles. So, for example, we have 56% of men aged between 18 to 25 strongly agree with the statement that full-time fathers are not real men. 70% of people in this age group agreed with the statement that a father's sole responsibility is to provide for his children. And in the overall sample, two-thirds of men agreed or strongly agreed with the statement, I don't think I am man enough unless I can provide for my family. Now, we all know the world that we live in at present. We live in very uncertain times. We live in a time where employment is much more flexible, that the career for life isn't really a thing anymore. For younger men in particular, this kind of role as being a provider, as being the breadwinner in the family, it's a much harder standard to maintain these days. And there is this kind of strain that goes along with that, that men can bear the ill of, that they feel like they're not measuring up to the ideal that they should.
And that's a really stark statistics that you just brought up there, Kenny, in terms of the societal expectations that society have put on men and that men now put on themselves, and how that actually replicates itself in terms of the expectation that boys have. Cormac, do you see that in terms of your work with young men, those expectations around providing, around being, making a lot of money, around all these kind of things, societally speaking?
Yeah, I think when we're speaking about young men, you often see that making a lot of money is something that, you know, when they're looking at their goals or who they want to be in the future, it tends to come up a lot. And yeah, I believe that a lot of those beliefs are often coming from their own fathers probably and from society. But I feel, just as Kenny was mentioning there, the fatherhood research, I do believe we really, even consciously or unconsciously, take on a lot from our own fathers, our father figures in our lives. And so it's sometimes, the adults that are maybe subtly giving us these beliefs as younger people. I often would challenge young people on, I'm not saying for me personally, I feel it's important for me to provide for my family. So I'm not saying it's not anything wrong with that, but at the same time, there can be a over focus on that being your sole role. Like, I also want to be a nurturing father and a present father with my, I have a young 10-month-old daughter as well. So I want to be there and not working all the time either. So again, it's finding that balance for me is what I want to do. But yeah, we often, when young people come with these beliefs, just challenge them and make sure that they're balanced, they're healthy, and they're not just saying it because that's what their own father thinks, or that's what, you know, people they're following on social media think.
Yeah, and I think, Cormac, the word that you put there was healthy, and that having that balance and not thinking of it as black and white, because oftentimes there can be black and white thinking when it comes to social roles and social expectations. And to your point there, the role of mentors, the role of parents, the role of people that are helping shape ideas, that's hugely important when it comes to men, if not all people, in terms of their sense of identity, but in this case, men, in terms of masculinity. Kenny, I want to ask you, how do you believe the role of people influencing mentors, fathers, coaches, how do you think that role shapes masculinity?
It does in a massive way. Like, we see, I suppose, at present, the kind of malign influence of the internet and the manosphere and stuff like that. And that is causing real and genuine problems. But I think what we need to do to look at the manosphere in particular is to look at why people like Andrew Tate or any other of the kind of manosphere influencers, why do they appeal to young men in particular?
And can you explain what the manosphere is? Some people may not know what that is.
The Manosphere is a loosely affiliated network line of like podcasters, internet personalities, influencers, or manfluencers as they call themselves. And they focus on topics relating to things such as men's health and fitness and relationships and dating, as well as further topics like finance and wealth. It's generally characterized by the promotion of very narrow and often harmful ideas of what masculinity is and what it means to be a man and how men should behave and look. Now, most of the stuff I've mentioned so far isn't harmful in itself or anything like that, but a lot of this stuff is couched in very, very blatant aggression against women, misogyny, often couched it with extreme racism and stuff like that as well, cars and expensive watches, and the claim that the lifestyle that they have is available to anyone who's prepared to exit the wage economy and to buy into any of the varying types of pyramid schemes that they sell. And this is a kind of key part of it, that most of it is underpinned kind of by scams and by pyramid schemes and training schemes and mentorship schemes and stuff like that. So I think the important thing is to look at what is it that young men are getting from these kind of influencers. And I mentioned earlier kind of that we live in uncertain times. And one of the things that these type of influencers give is this idea of certainty. If you have problems in your life, X, Y, and Z are the cause of them, and here's what you can do to make it better, whether that's working out 5 times a day or whether it's putting all your money into one of my pyramid schemes. It is that sense of certainty that it gives. It also gives young men a sense of, I suppose, a group identity, for want of a better term. It gives a sense of community to people who are often living quite lonely and atomized lives. And it gives them a direct, simple and legible script with which to orient their behavior. And when we kind of dig down into this, it can actually get quite depressing when we work through it. There's often a doom loop which happens where a young or lonely young man will be drawn to a manosphere influencer, or actually not, they'll be drawn to them, they'll be targeted by them. And these alienated and often lonely young men will be taught attitudes and behaviours that will only serve to further alienate and marginalise them. And often when this happens, they'll be sold access to further courses or to other programmes, and it'll continue the process of kind of dragging them deeper in and charging them top dollar for the privilege. And it's a very kind of ruthless and callous business model where young men are groomed into social isolation so they can continue to be sold dubious courses or merchandise or training or stuff like that.
Listening to it from personally, it's quite sad how people would target young men in such a way that are already in a vulnerable state of mind and can be susceptible to receiving and hearing such content that provides that sense of identity and belonging. Because fundamentally speaking, everybody wants to feel like they belong. People using these avenues to cultivate that is quite sad and dangerous. And Cormac, do you see the young men or the people that are engaging with your programs susceptible to this kind of content online?
Yeah, I suppose from my experience, you know, we've worked with over 15,000 young people across Ireland. And so we have worked with a lot of young men, and we have men's circles, you know, once they get to around 15, 16, we tend to split the boys and the girls for some of the workshop and have a specific circle just for the young men to kind of talk about these things. And I suppose one thing that I would say is that I don't believe it's as prevalent as maybe sometimes we think, because I think a lot of young men maybe were caught up in it at the start, you know, when a couple of years ago, when Andrew Tate maybe first came out, and maybe people got caught up in it. But then I think some of them started to see through it, because I think we also have to give young people credit. A lot of them are, you know, quite self-aware too, and they can spot something when it's not authentic. But there is still a cohort that are maybe more susceptible to falling into these traps, as Kenny outlined, and maybe are feeling a bit more isolated. And I suppose what it points out to me is that young men are craving some sort of community and this mentorship from older men to be guided, you know, into manhood. And that's what we have actually created ourselves, is a rites of passage experience to do this in a healthy way, to give young men a feeling of community and mentorship from older men, but to help them become their true selves, and to help them explore things like anger in a healthy way, and how to express anger in a healthy way and not bottle it up, to learn how to feel into your grief, to learn how to connect with others, to look at what your values are. So it's all about trying to empower the young man to really see who he wants to be and the type of man he wants to be, and leave behind some of these more childish ways. So we have rites of passage weekends, and we've one next summer for young men. And another really important part of it is to get a blessing from older men to, you know, I see you, I see your potential. And I think that's a lot of the time what they're actually craving, is this recognition, often maybe trying to get it from the external world by success or money or fame or whatever it is. But if we get that recognition from, you know, older men and mentors to really see who we are and, you know, help us move towards that potential, I think that's what they're really craving.
That's a beautiful way of putting it about, like, that recognition of themselves, recognition of their identity, and recognition of their humanity as well, is oftentimes what most people are craving. And particularly when it comes to boys and men, it's important that these traits, particularly the traits around healthy relationships, healthy engagement with others, healthy engagement with women and other genders, it's important that the work that you guys are doing is incredible in engaging with it. And I want to ask you, Dr. Kenny, as well, when it comes to those relationships with women and other genders, what kind of work are you doing to support men to collaborate?
Well, the big bit of work we're doing at present is actually with teachers. Mm-hmm. We run the White Ribbon Schools program, which is a mixture of online and in-person learning. There's, I think, 6 modules developed that teachers do. How do we bring these conversations safely into a classroom? And that kind of thing. And again, the tenor of those talks is generally going back to the strengths-based approach, that it's about kind of, particularly with young men, it's about telling them that they do have power in the world, and they can use their position and they can use the power that they have to make the world better for themselves and for everyone else around them.
That's beautiful. And it's important for men and teachers. And I love the approach that you put, in terms of it's not directly towards the students, but it's the people that are creating the environment for learning to have the skills to empower the students, educate the students, and have them understand about their own power within the world. Regarding that as well, the connection to emotion, it is a huge pillar for people to not only understand themselves, but understand how they're in relation with each other. Emotions in themselves can be quite uncomfortable to engage with. Cormac, in your work, do you find that it is easy or other not easy, or how do you engage with that layer of emotion with working with men?
Yeah, so I suppose when we're working in the school setting, it would be more so teaching them tools to start to build that connection with themselves, connection to their body, to how they're feeling. So the tools like meditation or breath work or different types of movements, journaling, just to kind of, yeah, build that capacity to tune in to what's going on inside. And then what we realized then is the need for these rites of passage experiences outside of the school, a bit more space to work on those, you know, deeper emotions like the anger and the grief that's maybe under the surface. And it's a bit harder to reach. And a lot of the time men are so disconnected from their feelings that they don't even know all of that grief and anger is under the surface. Like I didn't know when I was growing up. I grew up playing football. I was very tough physically and didn't show any emotion. But it was only as I grew older and started to learn how to look inside that I found there was, yeah, a lot that's under the surface. So it's, yeah, just bringing them through it in a way that's they're able to process these deeper emotions. But obviously having the right environment is important to do that.
Well, folks, that was Dr. Kenny Doyle and Cormac Noonan. And if you're listening and you're affected by anything we discussed in the conversation today, you can contact Women's Aid Free Phone Helpline at 1-800-341-900. Up next after the break, we'll be joined by an iconic HIV activist who'll be sharing her story. Welcome back. You're listening to Unified. Now, what comes to your mind when you're hearing the words living with HIV? Is it fear or outdated assumptions? Well, you're not alone. So joining me today on What's Your Story is activist Rebecca Talon de Hallevant to share her story about living with HIV and how it's transformed her identity, perspective and her activism today. Welcome, Rebecca.
Thank you so much and thank you for having me.
We're delighted to have you. When it comes to your story, can you tell us about just who you are and your story and what brought you to this activism?
Okay, yeah, it's quite a story to start with. I'm 68 and I'm a transitioned woman, male to female, and I transitioned in the 80s. And I had to move to London because here it was still very Catholic. Not that I'm not Catholic, but it was like severely Catholic, and it was very hard to be anything other than heterosexual, let's put it that way. Also as well, it was still illegal to be gay in Ireland until 1993. So this was the 80s, you know. I was a hair and makeup artist. I was a model agent. And I kind of lost my career overnight because it got plastered all over the Sunday newspapers. But anyway, I got okayed to have my gender reassignment surgery in London in the 80s. And at that stage, you had to have an AIDS test. Now, I'm more than sure that the AIDS test was for people of the LGBT community rather than my posh friends in Chelsea that I was with, you know what I mean, that were heterosexual or whatever. Anyway, I come from Ranelagh, so I thought, well, that can't happen to me. So I got the test and I had to wait over a month at the time. And it came back and I was brought into the hospital and I was told that I had AIDS and that I'd under 2 years to live. And that and the only question I asked at the time, but can I still have my surgery? And they went, absolutely no. Mm. And I came out of there and I was more, to be, if I'm being honest, I was more upset and angry that after all I'd gone through to have my surgery, to put wrongs to rights, that then I'm told I couldn't have it because of this terrible disease or virus or whatever, that I still really, I suppose, at the time, didn't understand the seriousness of it. Do you know what I mean? Okay, I had seen, in fairness, I'd seen the likes of Rock Hudson die, Freddie Mercury, but they're like kind of Hollywood. You know, I didn't think that could happen to somebody like me. You know, so it took a long time for it to actually register that I had this and that there was no cure and that there was no medication, you know. And then I realised that I did probably only have 2 years to live. I was told to come home to Ireland and tell my nearest and dearest, which I, in fairness, I think, if I had that choice over again, I probably would have held on till I processed it more myself. And that's the advice I would give in today's world with anything like that. Because once it's said, it can't be unsaid or unheard, you know? So anyway, long and short of it, I managed to get a surgeon that would do my surgery in 1991. So, of course, everything was double-gloved and you were waited until the end of the day. We were treated like, it was so horrible how we were treated. But at the same time, I kind of understand it to a point because back then, you know, all people were seeing, you know, on television. I just spoke to a man here in reception before and he remembers when he was only 8, the tombstones falling out of the sky around AIDS. You know what I mean? So imagine that man that I spoke to, like at 8 years of age, remembers that. So it was very doom and gloom for that. Anyway, I went on. I had my surgery. I survived it. And I was there then for the first medications, for which then became kind of HIV. I went through the whole thing of from maybe about 14, 15 tablets a day to one tablet a day. You know, so that journey, you know, in today's world, people were kind of coming a bit blasé and say, oh, well, I can just take one tablet for that. And it kind of like stabbing me in the heart because I think, well, honey, yeah, you can, because people like myself did the whole
The work
into this, and you know, the lab ratting, as I call it, you know. So, but with that came a lot of my own kind of stigma.
And what was that?
It was just like it got to a stage, like being in all fairness, where, and it's really hard to say this, but it's very true, that death became like normal.
And that's a hard thing, an extremely hard thing to sit with.
Yeah,
you know. How has that evolved your sense of self? Specifically in moving back to Ireland, in telling people the quote-unquote death sentence that you had, how's that evolved in terms of your sense of self now?
It probably by accident, really. You know, I mean, I went on a big journey then of being an addict, you know, being an alcoholic, being a heroin addict, because there was nothing open to people like myself in London at the time. You know, we weren't even allowed to have bank accounts because of AIDS and being a trans woman. So it basically, in society, we didn't exist. The only society we existed was in Soho, where everybody kind of like went to Soho. It was like a melting pot of disastrous people that made a perfect storm. You know, it was the most wonderful place to be, I have to say. And without it, I don't know what I would have done. But when I got sober 21 years ago, which I'm really proud of.
Congratulations.
Then I started to thaw out and started to get my feelings back. And that's the good and the bad of it. And then there was this Work Positive programme in Terence Higgins Trust, which would be one of the main kind of charities in London that deal with HIV and AIDS. And I started then to kind of listen and hear things. And then somebody said to me, you should tell your story. And I thought, I can't tell my story. I can't tell my story back in Ireland. I've already been condemned because I'm a trans woman. I didn't want to talk about this. So eventually I did. I did talk about it. And I knew that I was going to have to talk about it. It would have to be seriously honest. I started talking, and then before I knew it, I was speaking in Amsterdam at like the HIV World European Convention, and it was just amazing. And I found the more I spoke about it, the more I was healing myself.
And I know it's been a massive journey for you and your life and your story, and you've been such an advocate and a leader in this space and hope for people that receive the diagnosis today. And I know Ireland, they've had a target specifically to eliminate new HIV transmissions by 2030. But the statistic says that we're actually quite off. What's the reason as to that?
It's funny you say that, because it's actually exactly 10 years ago to the month, I think, where when I was intern at Higgins Trust this time 10 years ago, that U equals U became, you know, like people learned about U equals U. It's like undetectable, untransmittable. So if you're on kind of HIV medication, which I am on, and I'm undetectable, it means I can't pass it on to anybody else. And a perfect example of that was a girl I've worked with quite a lot in London, and she's amazing. She's one of my heroes, really. And she got pregnant and got diagnosed with a HIV diagnosis, got on medication straight away, gave birth to her baby, and the baby didn't have HIV. And she's had another baby since. So if a woman can carry a child inside her system for 9 months and she's on medication and she can't pass it on to her, I mean, that's the next best thing to a miracle. So we're at that stage. But in saying that, I remember also, because I worked at 5016 Street in London and Chelsea Westminster Hospital, and I also remember, by 2030, it'll be no transmissions, no new transmissions. And I just thought, I don't think so. Because basically what you're really dealing with still is the gay community, or you're hitting on minorities as such as like the black community. Do you know what I mean? But you're not like kind of like taking into consideration menopausal women or trans women, you know? And until you kind of treat it like it's COVID, you know, HIV is not fussy. It doesn't care what color, gender, how rich or poor you are. If it's coming for you, it'll get you. You know, and that's the thing. So until we will never get to, sorry, I know I'm very passionate, but we will never get to this 0-0 and we start treating everybody. Mm. And for me, the biggest problem is as well, apart from trans women, is menopausal women, because they're not taking the pill anymore. They're probably divorced and out having a great time. I'm eating guys. Believe you me, I'm in my 60s and I get hit on by young guys all the time. So it's quite flattering. You know, but the average woman is saying, oh, well, I can't get pregnant anymore. Mm. They never stop to think for one minute that they can catch HIV or any other STIs. So until we personally deal rigorously with that, we're not going to get, we couldn't possibly get to 0-0.
And like, why do you think that, what I was hearing from you is that there's a targeted focus on education and testing and engagement with certain communities as opposed to all communities. Why do you think that's the case?
I think it's a very, it, sometimes I feel personally it's a bit white supremacy. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Especially around middle class white women. Mm-hmm. Because they are really under the illusion that they can't, this can't happen. You know, you don't get that from, we say anyone that's in a minority group, they know anything is possible, sadly. You know what I mean? We all know. You know, I'm a trans woman, I know anything is possible. Mm-hmm. But the reason why trans women aren't probably kind of taken up on this too, because of the stigma. Being a trans woman is already a stigma. You know, if you already have a stigma and then you add another stigma, then you become a minority within a minority. Mm-hmm. Which is a really bad place to be, you know, and we should never even have to be there or contemplate anybody being in that, you know. So for me, I just think with trans women, we were told at one stage that if we did have HIV and we were on medication, it would affect our hormone replacement stuff for transitioning. And that's not the case anymore. I'm the perfect example of that. I'm 68 now. I'm on my HRT. I'm on my medication. And I was told at 29, I had 2 years to live. And here I am, a senior citizen, you know. So more people need to see me and hear from me and hear from people like myself that it doesn't matter who I am or what gender I am, what colour my skin is. I have HIV, but I am you equals you. Mm.
And that's a beautiful way to encapsulate it. And when you say senior citizen, I have to say for those who are listening, a fabulous one by that in terms of the outfit and everything. I'm loving it. And specifically like that you equals you and the understanding that once you are medicated, once you have your medication for HIV, that it cannot be transmitted. Mm. But a lot of people aren't aware as to that there is, like you said, a lot of stigma surrounding those who are affected by the virus. If anybody were listening and still may have ideas or reservations around HIV, what is one thing you'd say to them?
Get tested. You know, get tested, because that's the most important thing. Because I think one of the greatest things that's happening too is late diagnosis. When it's a late diagnosis, that, you know, at that stage, like medication or nothing can really help you, you know. So get tested. And we do rapid testing in HIV Ireland, right? And I call it the 60-second kind of mind-blown thing. Because as you do the test, you can see that person, doesn't matter who they are. So for 1 minute, for 60 seconds, they have this idea, what if I do have HIV? So it gives them some insight on what it would be like. And then they get a negative and they're like, oh my God, I'm going to change all this. I'm going to wear condoms. I'm going to do all of this. And it does change people's attitude. But it also, if somebody does get a diagnosis, if we get it in time, they get on medication straight away. It doesn't affect anything, their life or anything. But why we're talking about that here now, there's a big crisis here in Ireland at the moment too, with a lot of women that I work with, brown, black women, you know what I mean, that are struggling with staying in this country and getting their medication and taking their medication. Mm. This should not be the case. You know what I mean? We really need to pull our finger out on this. You know, it's not trans lives. It's human lives matter. Mm. We're all human beings. We deserve this. I don't care. I just think it's so, I think it's so narrow-minded and naive to think that we can't face this, because, you know, like, I mean, unless we do something now, this is what's going to happen. You can't put a Band-Aid on this. I always say, okay, we take the med. I take one tablet a day. I live forever. Probably live longer than anybody, you know. Mm-hmm. But if I stop taking my medication, it's still the same old virus living inside me. I will die. I will get an AIDS-related illness at some stage and die. So the virus hasn't changed, just the medication has.
And I suppose for your work and your call to especially the what we want to do in eliminating, what is one final call, especially for those who are listening and those who have attitudes surrounding HIV, what is that final call for those to change, not change attitudes, but understand more better the experiences?
Very good point. Also as well, like I feel as well, another thing that I want to say, like the reason why, and I see a lot of people that are migrants living here, you know, that unless you are living, and I know this from myself, I'm even living in London, unless you're living in good accommodation, that you can live a good life, that you can eat healthily and all of that, then you will take your medication. But if all of that falls apart, then you don't see the reason why. But for me, to the average person that's listening to this today, you're not exempt. You know, HIV is not fussy. You know, we're all kind of sleeping around a lot more. Everything's a lot more fluidity. Everything's a lot more this. And we're all in Ireland. We're afraid to talk about sex, but nearly everybody has sex. You know what I mean? So get tested. Look after yourself. Wear a condom. You know, simple things mean a big thing. You know, unless you want to take tablets for the rest of your life, you know.
That's super important. And thank you so much, Rebecca, for coming on, being vulnerable and telling your story, because it is a hard topic, especially in a culture like Ireland where we don't want to talk about things. It's a hard topic to talk about. Thank you again for coming on the show.
My pleasure, always.
Up next, we'll be hearing from Irish Rail and particularly what rail customers with disabilities can expect with assisted travel in their new platform that's coming out later on this year. Stay with us. Welcome back. You're listening to Unified. Now, when it comes to transport, a lot of us have the opportunity and privilege to have access to buses, railways, and supports that allow us to get from A to B. But for those who have disabilities, they need additional supports that will support them in transport. Well, Irish Rail are actually providing and creating a new assistance platform that is going to support those who are living with disabilities to make their journeys more accessible, easier, and more smoother when it comes from getting to their destination. And today, joining me to discuss this new platform is Barry Kenny, their corporate communications manager in Irish Rail, to discuss the platform, why it's needed, and what we're going to expect later on this year. Hi, Barry. How are you?
Thanks, Mabubba. I'm good. How are you?
Great. So can you tell us an overview about the platform and what it's doing in terms of accessibility?
Well, we obviously have to ensure that our services, both today and as we invest in them, are accessible to everybody. We are a national public transport provider. It's critical that everybody in our society is able to use that. And we're working with an infrastructure that was originally built in the 19th century. It takes time to upgrade. But right now we have, I suppose, about 65,000 assisted journeys a year. That's where customers either who have a disability or another requirement contact us to say we need assistance in terms of either boarding or alighting or both of our journeys. And that works very successfully. But it's very manually based. It's and I think what it can cause is people, I suppose, a degree of uncertainty in knowing how their journey is going to be delivered. So this new platform, it's a passenger assistance management system, but for users, it's going to be very much an app, a website, a call centre, is about giving that assurance, particularly for more complicated journeys, because you're going from Houston to Cork, you're going between two big stations, it's a fairly straightforward journey. If you're going from Limerick to Blackrock, you're going to Limerick Junction, you're going to go to Houston, you're going to presumably take the Lewis or a bus service and then onto the Dart. So with us, that's three separate journeys. And so what this will do is give customers greater reassurance in terms of being able to book their assistance at any time, confirm that the assistance is going to be provided, and also then give our own staff, I suppose, the greater visibility of where the assistance is required at any time. It'll make journeys easier. Ultimately, what we're trying to do is get to independent access in any event, but it'll help us to reduce the type of notice periods that currently apply for some of our journeys.
And I suppose that's fantastic to hear that this platform exists and it's being used and adopted for your thousands of customers that need that support. But my question is, like, it's 2026. You think something like this already should be existing. Why are we here and only having this conversation now?
I suppose it is something we've been looking at for a few years. I'll be straight up with you. And the technology has developed. This is not a trial technology. This is actually in use in some railways in Britain and in Japan as well. Transreport are the name of the company that are providing this. So we'll be their first deployment in the European Union of this type of technology. As I say, it is about where assistance is needed. What we need to get to in a more, I suppose, broader sense is having people travel without having to have assistance, and things like our investment in infrastructure, not to go off topic for a moment, but, you know, our new trains coming next year, the new DART trains, they will have a retractable step that will mean for the vast majority of people who are mobility impaired, independent access will be possible on those trains. And as we expand those to the network, that's where we need to get to. But that takes time in replacing trains. It takes many hundreds of millions of euro to replace a fleet. This is about where we are now and giving that greater certainty and greater confidence in the assistance that's there today.
And I suppose in the creation of the local context here in Ireland, I want to know, were the customers involved who have disability in terms of creating it? Were there other organisations that advocate for disability rights? Were they a part of the process in creating it? Can you let us know more?
Yeah, we have a disability users group that has representative bodies and users involved. And that inputs into all of our decisions and all of our investment in terms of provision for customers with accessibility. That ranges from, as I say, how we design new trains to our customer service training for our staff. So they would have been very much involved in the requirements that are here, the type of clarity, the type of issues that users who require assistance encounter when travelling with us, so that we're effectively solving the issue as opposed to coming up with a concept ourselves. And that goes through, I mentioned customer training. We have our customer service training for our staff in terms of providing assistance is now with the Wayfinding Centre, Vision Ireland Wayfinding Centre in Glasnevin, which is a transformative training programme. I've done the course myself, in its pilot phase, and that is users of our service, of public transport services generally, guiding our staff in terms of how best to assist. And it's well worth a visit. We have a disused DART carriage in that facility. There are buses, there are Lewis carriages. There's a part of an old Air France plane, literally, so service providers can understand, can see the challenges that customers with disabilities encounter when travelling us, and therefore adapt our service and provide a better service to assist travel.
That's super important, and that's really great to hear that sort of in-depth training and knowledge is there for the people that are providing the service, but also that the platform has been informed by people who have disabilities. And I understand that it's something that's being rolled out. Can you give us a timeline when it's coming out and what people should expect?
We would see it from October onwards that we'll go live. It'll be phased. So we'll look at probably some of the major stations first, and obviously we'll communicate with customers and indeed with the representative groups before it is introduced. But we'll be looking at introducing in a number of our major stations first from October. So covering kind of some of the more common journeys, and then rolling it out over the following, you know, weeks, stroke months to the full network to ensure that we have it working properly, that people again have confidence in it, and deploying it fully across the network by the early part of 2027. It will be there, a multi-platform. Right now, if you want to contact our accessibility office, it's office hours. This is 24/7. You've got the resources in terms of being able to book your travel, self-service, have the confirmation sent to you, have meeting points sent to you, all that type of detail, giving a basically a more seamless travel experience.
And I suppose it's that phased approach is needed, but what would you say to like the people living in rural areas that may need the support when the time comes out and they see something like this?
Well, we say, the assistance is there, and I would say, and it's an issue, you know, people say, well, why do you have notice periods at all? And I think many assistances are provided without notice. We give the advice effectively to guarantee it, because you have some stations, you mentioned rural areas, we have some stations where you've got a platform that at this point is not accessible. So you've got an accessible platform and one that we don't have lifts or we don't have ramps to access. But we can direct a train into the accessible platform if a customer has arranged the assistance for us. So that's, one of the reasons that a notice period is there. We've reduced it in 13 major stations to 1 hour. As I say, the goal for everywhere is to get rid of these kind of notice periods. And this and new trains are the type of thing that will help us do that. So I hope people will see, our commitment to it. Perfect world, you would obviously flick a switch and it would be on everywhere. but I think it's right to ensure that it's working, the customers have confidence in it before you expand it to everywhere.
And do you have specific targets as to the usage of the app? I know you have, is it over 65,000 people of your customers that need disability supports? Is there any targets that you have as you roll out in October onwards?
Well, you want to see the numbers increasing because you want people to have confidence to make the journey in the first place. And I suppose that's something that is very hard to measure. How many people are not traveling, are not participating fully in society, in the economy, because that barrier or that perceived barrier is there. So the numbers of assistants are increasing. Anyway, we want to take away the barriers so as we see numbers increase quite dramatically. So it's not a case of saying we want a target, we want this to grow to what the actual demand is that is there. And then, as I say, when we start bringing in things like the new trains, obviously you will likely see that number reduce because most people on the Dart, when those trains come in, who currently book assistance, will not need to book assistance at all because there'll be literally the retractable step at every single door on those trains, meaning you don't have to position yourself at a certain part of the platform. It is independent access, which is what we all need to work towards.
And that independent access is super important. And is there a way that people can like sign up? Is there a wait list? Is there things that they can start anticipating for something like this?
As I say, when it is actually available, yeah, we will publicise that in terms of registering for this and having the service available. We'll be communicating with customers directly. We'll also be communicating with the representative groups so as they ensure that people on their databases are aware. And again, as I say, we would hope we would see a very kind of quick jump in the number of people seeking assistance because that barrier is removed, or again, that perceived barrier is removed.
And finally, what is Irish Rail's hope for this platform? We know it's long time coming and it's long time needed.
What we hope is, I suppose, is that it is a measure that encourages more travel from customers who require assistance. Now, I think it will also support the ongoing investment programme in terms of what we need to do to improve. I mentioned Darts. We've also just ordered a new fleet of trains for the Enterprise, for the Dublin-Belfast line. We are doing similar in terms of the retractable step there. So again, that will be the first intercity route on the network that will not require assistance as well. And that is just the progress that has to keep happening. That, you know, trains when they're in service, like the original Dart fleet is in service over 40 years. So when you are getting new trains now, we have to make sure they're right. And we have to make sure that they are to the absolute highest standards of accessibility. And I think by demonstrating the demand and the requirement that is there through this, that will help us as we seek funding for that.
Thank you so much. That was Barry Kenny, who is the Corporate Communications Manager at Irish Rail. Barry, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Mobo.
That brings us to the end of today's episode of Unified. It is supported by Commissioner Man. Find us on podcasts on the Go Loud app or share your thoughts at unified@newstalk.com. That's Unified with a Y-O-U. Thank you, Marisol Sullivan, for producing, and Aisha Nevi on research. Join us again next week for more on Unified, Sundays at 8 p.m. on News Talk. See you then.